The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the March 7th, 2014 edition of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Putin ratchets up pressure on Ukraine. What happened? Russian President Vladimir Putin put 150,000 troops at the Ukraine border on high alert this week and cut off $15 billion in financial aid to the almost bankrupt country in a clear attempt to intimidate Ukraine's interim government. Russia's show of strength came just days after pro-European protesters toppled Ukraine's Kremlin-backed president Viktor Yanukovych, forcing him to flee Kiev by battling security forces and riot police in fiery street battles that left more than 80 people dead. The interim government issued a warrant for the ex-president's arrest on charges of mass murder, but he remained at large and is believed to be hiding in the southern region of Crimea, which has a majority ethnic Russian population. Russian officials refused to recognize Ukraine's interim government, which they dismissed as a Kalashnikov-toting people in black mask, and expressed concerns for the safety of ethnic Russians in eastern Ukraine and Crimea, language similar to their justification for invading Georgia in 2008. In Crimea, pro-Russian activists clashed with supporters of the new government and called on Moscow to intervene and protect the region from authorities in Kiev. But Secretary of State John Kerry warned Putin to respect Ukraine's territorial integrity and avoid an old Cold War confrontation. U.S. and European officials were also scrambling to put together a financial package to prop up Ukraine's debt-loaded economy, with the country's finance minister saying it would need $35 billion to survive 2014 and 2015. What the editorial said: Ukraine's revolutionaries urgently need the West's help, said the Wall Street Journal. The country has the building blocks of democracy, a parliament, opposition parties, and free media, but it is hobbled by its post-Soviet corruption-riddled economy. The International Monetary Fund must arrange a loan to keep the country afloat, and the European Union should offer Ukraine membership, giving its new leaders an incentive and roadmap to reform. The West can't stabilize Ukraine without Russia, said the New York Times. If Moscow is excluded from the transition process, ethnic Russians in the country's east will feel that the West is forcing a new nationalist government on them. That would only fuel separatist movements. The key is to persuade all Ukrainians that a democratic Ukraine with ties to Europe can also maintain the culture, language, and history it shares with Russia. What the columnist said: for an autocrat like Putin, the sight of Yanukovych being driven from his palace is a nightmare, said John McLaughlin in USA Today. Russia's czar knows that if liberal democracy takes hold next door, many middle-class Russians will get dangerous ideas. That scenario is so terrifying to the Russian autocrat that he may look for a pretext to intervene militarily and install a Russian-friendly government in the east. Russia won't invade, said Dmitry Trenin in the New York Times. The last thing Putin wants is a civil war next door. Prolonged instability would hurt the Kremlin financially, as the pipelines that carry Russian natural gas to customers in Western Europe run straight through Ukraine. Instead, Putin will use economic weapons to intimidate, if not blackmail, the interim rulers in Kiev, said Nicholas Burns in the Boston Globe. If the new government joins the EU and snubs Moscow, Putin could stop supplying the country with natural gas that Ukrainians need to heat their homes. Or he could place new tariffs and restrictions on goods from Ukraine, which sends 25% of its exports to Russia. Putin will be prepared to play a tough, cynical game. In the end, the biggest threat to the revolution is not Putin, said Simon Schuster in Time.com. It's Ukraine's economy, which is in utter shambles. Whoever wins presidential elections scheduled for May faces a possible default on the country's national debt, causing the price of basic goods to skyrocket and the currency's value to plummet. Demonstrators could soon be gathered outside the offices and homes of today's revolutionaries. Ukrainians have developed a taste for protest. They're great at it, and they will use their people power no matter who is in charge. And now the controversy of the week. Religious freedom threatened by gay marriage? Now that religious conservatives realize they're losing the gay marriage wars, said Gabrielle Arana in Prospect.org, they have hit on a desperate new tactic. Legalize discrimination against gays under the banner of religious liberty. In Republican-controlled states across the nation, so far Arizona, Georgia, Kansas, Idaho, Mississippi, South Dakota, and Tennessee, legislators have submitted or passed bills that would authorize businesses and individuals to refuse service to gays, lesbians, and same-sex couples if, in the words of the Arizona law, serving them would violate business owners' sincerely held religious beliefs. Governor Jan Brewer was expected to veto the Arizona bill this week after a national backlash threatened the state's tourism and convention business. But this fight is just beginning. Sponsors of these laws say they would exempt a Christian florist, baker, or photographer from providing services to a same-sex wedding, said Kristen Powers in USA Today. Most are written so vaguely, however, as to allow any business or individual to legally discriminate against any gay person for any reason. These are, in effect, homosexual Jim Crow laws. Freedom should be a two-way street, said Ryan Anderson in NationalReview.com. Americans are free to live and love how they choose, but they are also free to worship God however they choose and to act in the public square based on those beliefs. Christian caterers, florists, and bakers have been sued for refusing to serve same-sex weddings, and Christian adoption agencies have been forced out of business for refusing to place children with same-sex couples. Those are flagrant violations of religious liberty. Try the moral math in reverse, said Kevin Williamson, also in NationalReview.com. Should a black baker be forced to bake a cake for a Ku Klux Klan wedding? Should a gay restaurant owner be guilty of a crime if he politely declines to rent out his dining room to the Westboro Baptist Church for their annual God Hates Fags Sunday brunch? Of course not. Freedom of conscience deserves as much legal protection as any other core American freedom. This argument is an obvious fig leaf for homophobic bigotry, said Andrew Sullivan in dish.andrewsullivan.com. The Bible expressly forbids the remarriage of divorced people, yet Christian florists, bakers, and photographers have been working such adulterous weddings for decades without complaint. People are entitled to their beliefs, said Noah Feldman in Bloomberg.com. but not when they violate other people's rights. Let's not forget that Southern segregationists also argued that it would violate their personal consciences and freedom of association if they were forced to serve blacks in their businesses or sit alongside them in schools and restaurants. If we reopen the door to legal discrimination to satisfy conservative Christians, bigots could claim the right to refuse to employ Muslims, sexually active single women, or Mormons. The real issue here isn't gay marriage, said Brian Beutler in Salon.com. As American society grows more liberal and more diverse, conservative extremists are seeking legal protection to live in isolated subcultures with their own rules. Hence the red state's refusal to comply with the Affordable Care Act, the legal war against the ACA's contraception mandate, and the slew of voter ID and stand your ground laws. As they watch their once dominant cosmology recede, social conservatives are seeking a waiver not just from gay marriage, but from the 21st century. It was a good week for Tesla. After Consumer Reports named the company's electric-powered Model S its best overall car, calling it a technological tour de force and giving it 99 out of 100 points, its highest ever rating. Tesla's stock is up more than 600% in a year. It was a good week for entrepreneurship. After a San Francisco Girl Scout set up a cookie stand outside a medical marijuana clinic and sold out her entire stash of munchies in just 45 minutes. They get very hungry after smoking, said Danielle Lee, age 13. It was a good week for the good book. After an Ohio bus driver was shot twice in the chest at close range by hoodlums, but survived because a Bible in his shirt pocket stopped the bullets. There was obviously some kind of intervention, said a police officer. It was a bad week for the ankles of Phoenix residents. After authorities in that Arizona city received more than 6,000 calls from people who'd been harassed by packs of feral, yapping chihuahuas. It was a bad week for Deonta Rose, a Texas man who allegedly fled police custody while still in handcuffs, then called 911 to request medical help, complaining that his manacles were cutting off the circulation in his arm. He was rearrested. And it was a bad week for fortune tellers. After a house in London burned down when a crystal ball magnified sunlight coming through a window, setting bedroom curtains alight. You can't predict the future, said a firefighter, but you can prevent this type of fire by keeping glass ornaments away from sunny windowsills. We'll take a look now at the briefing page. The return of childhood diseases. With vaccination rates falling, diseases that once were nearly eradicated are making a comeback. Why are vaccination rates falling? Since the late 1990s, a growing number of American parents have become convinced, against all scientific evidence, that the risks of immunization outweigh the benefits. Their fears are rooted in a now discredited 1998 study by a British doctor, Andrew Wakefield, who claimed that the onset of autism in 12 British children was linked to their being vaccinated for measles, mumps, and rubella, MMR. But subsequent studies failed to replicate Wakefield's findings, and an investigation found that his study was an elaborate fraud with deliberately falsified data. Nonetheless, Wakefield's bogus study started a wave of apprehension and confusion that continues to spread. In some states, from 5 to 8% of parents got a personal belief exemption to prevent their children from being vaccinated in 2012. Overall, more than 10% of parents are either delaying when their children are vaccinated or not getting the shots at all. Every year, the number of kids getting exempted from vaccines grows, said Dr. Lawrence Madoff, director of epidemiology and immunization for Massachusetts. When immunization rates fall, it doesn't take long, even in a developed country, for diseases to resurge. Is that happening? Unfortunately, yes. In recent years, there have been multiple outbreaks of measles, whooping cough, and other childhood diseases that not long ago were virtually wiped out by vaccination. In 2012, about 50,000 Americans contracted whooping cough, a highly infectious respiratory illness that causes convulsive coughing for weeks and can be fatal to infants. It was the largest outbreak of that bacterial illness in more than half a century, and at least 18 people died. About 190 measles cases were reported in 2013, triple the previous year, virtually all in communities where there were large numbers of unvaccinated people. The anti-vaccine body count website, which is based on federal statistics, says that since 2007, 128,000 Americans have come down with preventable illnesses due to lack of vaccination, with 1,336 deaths. Who is rejecting vaccines? Anti-vaxxers, as people who oppose vaccination are called, and come from across the political and geographic spectrum. They include back-to-the-land progressives in Brooklyn and Oregon who see vaccines as unnatural, libertarians who distrust government recommendations, and rural religious conservatives suspicious of science and modernity. Their ranks swelled when actress Jenny McCarthy publicly blamed her son's autism on vaccines and in 2007 launched a high-profile campaign with a book and TV appearances to educate the public about the dangers of vaccination. Some anti-vaxxers adamantly insist that vaccines are responsible for the autism epidemic of recent years, despite multiple studies that have found no link. Others have adopted the idea that giving vaccines for 16 different illnesses to infants in their first 2 years of life may somehow overwhelm their immune systems and trigger autism and other neurological and developmental disorders. What's the evidence for this belief? There is none. Modern vaccines contain very tiny amounts of killed, weakened, or partial portions of viruses and bacteria. In fact, researchers have found that the number of such antigens in the entire current recommended course of childhood vaccinations is just 315, compared to several thousands in the 1990s. New vaccines provide only the minimum amount of material needed to create an immune response to give the child protection, says Michael Brady, chairman of the American Academy of Pediatrics Committee on Infectious Diseases. Every day, experts point out, infants are exposed to dozens of living bacteria and viruses without overloading their immune systems. The preservative thimerosal, which some anti-vaxxers claim caused autism, hasn't been in childhood vaccines for a decade. Are immunized people now at risk? Yes. The effects of most vaccinations diminish over time, so adults who haven't received booster shots can get measles, whooping cough, and other diseases from an unvaccinated person. That's why deciding not to get vaccinated is not simply a matter of personal choice. When vaccination rates are 95% or higher, the unvaccinated are protected because exposure is so rare thanks to herd immunity. As more individuals opt out of vaccinations, the risk of exposure for the unvaccinated or undervaccinated increases dramatically. What can be done? Bioethicist Arthur Kaplan recently proposed holding people legally responsible for the illnesses and related damage they cause by not having their children vaccinated. Individuals can make their own choice not to vaccinate, Kaplan said, but that does not protect the person making that choice against the consequence of that choice for others. Most health officials, however, think the best strategy is to conduct a tireless public education campaign against the false fears of vaccinations. Children have gotten sick because of this fraud, said Dr. Aaron Carroll, professor of pediatrics at the Indiana University School of Medicine. It's likely that some children have died. Vaccinate your kids, please. And the Inset article here, the autism epidemic. Vaccines do not cause autism, says the Mayo Clinic. But what does? From 2002 to 2013, rates of autism, a neurological disorder marked by pronounced social withdrawal, soared 300%. 1 in 50 children is now diagnosed with an autism spectrum disorder. The cause is unknown, though research has indicated it may be a mix of genetic and environmental factors, along with more diagnoses because of heightened awareness. A 2012 Danish study found that fathers older than 35 had a 28% higher chance of having an autistic child. That suggests that the genetic mutations that are more common among older parents may be a factor. Another study found that when one twin has autism, there's a 70% chance the second twin does too, indicating that genes play a big role, but not a determinative one. Though research continues, most experts now believe that autism is caused by a complex interaction of multiple genes, anywhere from 3 to 20, with environmental toxins, viral infections, or hormonal disturbances, probably while a fetus is still in the womb. Now the best columns from the U.S. First from Richard McNider and John Christie at the Wall Street Journal. The science isn't settled on warming. You don't have to be a flat earther to be skeptical of catastrophic climate change predictions, said atmospheric scientists Richard McNider and John Christie. While we acknowledge that growing carbon dioxide levels are warming Earth's atmosphere, we do not agree with the prevailing wisdom that the warming will necessarily be extreme. All predictions of future temperature increases are based on computer modeling of the atmosphere, and such models, which attempt to duplicate an incredibly complex interaction of various gases, sunlight, clouds, heat absorption by the ocean, and dozens of other variables, have been consistently and spectacularly wrong since the 1980s. Built by scientists who already believe in catastrophic global warming, the models keep predicting more than triple the temperature increase that actually occurs. The models fail to predict the recent pause in global warming, as well as the fact that the Arctic has warmed significantly, while lower latitudes have not. Given their track record of error, shouldn't modelers be more humble and admit that climate change is something they don't fully understand? This from Jack Hamilton at Slate.com. Gay athletes need not be a distraction. When backup center Jason Collins played his first game of the season this week, said Jack Hamilton, his presence on an NBA court was historic, and yet not really a big deal at all. The 7-foot Collins, signed by the Brooklyn Nets, became the first openly gay player to play in one of America's 4 major professional sports leagues. A Lakers crowd in Los Angeles gave the opposing player a moving ovation when Collins came into the game, and then Collins' sexual orientation quickly became irrelevant. The veteran 35-year-old failed to score a point in 11 minutes, but played the unspectacular, hard-nosed game that's kept him in the NBA for more than a decade. When Collins first revealed that he is gay in a Sports Illustrated cover story last summer, No team signed him, amid the usual passive-aggressive grumblings that he might prove to be a distraction. But Collins' unremarkable debut proved that gay athletes can be just athletes. No distractions necessary. That's why, in the first NBA game featuring an openly gay player, absolutely everybody won. And finally, from Peter Wehner at CommentaryMagazine.com, why won't the GOP reject Nugent? Ted Nugent is a repulsive figure with a long history of saying awful things, said Peter Wehner. The former rock star and outspoken gun rights advocate outdid himself last week when he called President Obama a subhuman mongrel on a Texas radio show. Nugent, who has been campaigning with Republican Greg Abbott in his race to be the next governor of Texas, later made a half-hearted apology. To call a mixed-race president subhuman and a mongrel is not simple rhetorical excess. It's borrowing the racist terminology of Nazi Germany and the Jim Crow South. And Nugent should now be a pariah. But Republicans who've cozied up to Nugent in the past, including Abbott, Governor Rick Perry, and Senator Ted Cruz, merely distanced themselves from Nugent's words, not Nugent himself. Some conservatives, meanwhile, muttered about media double standards. The fact that Republicans refuse to denounce Nugent sends a clear message to voters. Either they really aren't offended by his calling Obama a subhuman mongrel, or they're afraid of alienating segments of their base who share Nugent's repellent views. And either explanation is an indictment. While we're on this page, I've got a "It Must Be True, I Read It in the Tabloids" blurb for you. An Iowa man was fired from his warehouse job after he allegedly used a forklift to pick up a vending machine and shake loose a stuck candy bar. When Robert McKevitt's $1 Twix got stuck on a spiral hook, supervisor said, he jumped into an 8,000-pound forklift and repeatedly lifted the vending machine 2 feet off the ground before dropping it on the concrete floor, freeing 3 candy bars. McKevitt was fired, but he insists he only used the forklift to move the machine back into place after shaking it. That machine was trouble, he said. And for you Sound of Music fans, an obituary this week. The singer whose life inspired the Sound of Music, Maria von Trapp, 1914 to 2014. Without Maria von Trapp, the Sound of Music would never have been made. The Broadway musical and film were based on the real-life romance between her father, Austrian naval captain Georg von Trapp, and her governess. And she was the reason the two met and fell in love. A childhood case of scarlet fever had left her unable to walk, so her widower father hired a trainee nun as her tutor. That tutor was Maria Kuchera, played by Julie Andrews in the film, who became the captain's second wife in 1927. The guitar-playing governess taught her 7 stepchildren to sing 4-part harmonies and started the family musical group, the Trapp Family Singers. When the Nazis annexed Austria in 1938, the anti-fascist Captain von Trapp turned down a German Navy commission and decided to flee the country with his entire family, said the Daily Telegraph. The von Trapps headed to America, playing concert tours and attracting Hollywood's attention. But when The Sound of Music debuted in 1965, Maria, renamed Luisa in the film to distinguish her from Andrew's character, was shocked at her father's portrayal as strict and obsessed with discipline, said the New York Times. In fact, she said, he always looked after us a lot, especially after our mother died. The family settled in Vermont and opened a ski lodge, where Maria played accordion and taught Austrian dance. In 2008, she revisited her childhood home of Salzburg for the first time since the 1930s. It was an emotional experience. "Our whole life is in here, in this house," she recalled, "especially here in the stairwell, where we always used to slide down the railings." And now we turn to the last word, the real paleo diet. "If you really want to copy our early ancestors' diet," said Daniela Martin, "you should be eating lots of bugs." You've probably heard of the Stone Age diet craze known as the Paleolithic diet, made popular most recently by Dr. Lauren Cordain's bestseller, The Paleo Diet. The premise is simple. If our early human ancestors couldn't have eaten it, we shouldn't either. It's the one time, it seems, that being like a caveman is a good thing. The theory goes, and archaeological evidence corroborates, that early hunter-gatherers, while they may not have lived as long, still had some major health advantages on most of us modern humans. They were much taller, averaging 6'5" to our 5'11", had stronger, heavier bones, had more robust immune systems, and were leaner, tougher, and hardier than we are today. Higher levels of physical activity also played a vital role in cave people's vitality, and so did their high levels of wild food consumption, wild game meat, gathered greens and fruits, and healthy fats such as nuts. Cordain suggests that prior to the agricultural revolution, early humans ate this paleo diet for 2.5 million years. The 10,000 years since the popularization of farming, or just 333 human generations, he says, is clearly a drop in the chronological bucket when compared with the millennia leading up to it. Thus, he maintains, the hunter-gatherer diet our ancestors lived on is far more deeply and indelibly imprinted into our DNA than our habits of the last few thousand years. I'm inclined to agree with him. In fact, I'm going to see his 2.5 million years and raise him a few millennia and show you what we are really designed to eat. The real paleo diet would have included bugs. Lots and lots of bugs. From the time mammals first appeared until 50 million years ago, a total of 150 million years, three-quarters of the entire time mammals have existed, our ancestors were primarily insectivorous. Write S. Boyd Eaton and Dorothy A. Nelson in their paper, Calcium in Evolutionary Perspective. Given the slow and conservative nature of genetic evolution, this long-standing adaptation for insect consumption must have made a significant impact on our genetic heritage. Consequently, the nutritional properties of insects have relevance for understanding the forces that have shaped the nutritional requirements of present-day humans. It's easy to observe this early pre-human diet in the wild today, since versions of this prehistoric bug guzzler still exist in the form of bush babies, tree shrews, and similar small mammals. It turns out that for a certain size of primate, bugs are one of the best things on the planetary menu. If we were still that size, that's pretty much all we'd eat, too. But for whatever reason, we grew in both body and brain size, and as we grew, it became harder to find enough insects to fulfill our daily nutritional requirements. The problem was not with the bugs themselves, but just that we couldn't find enough of them. We had to start branching out. We had to find something more dependable as a source of calories than that which could see us coming and, say, crawl into a hole. So we started eating plants, which, of course, couldn't run away. This is one of the miracles and geniuses of being a primate. Our innate adaptability to different diets, also known as omnivory, omni equals everything, vory equal eating, we adapted so that we could eat everything and anything and still survive. We changed inside and out in order to take advantage of the different types of nutrient sources around us, and as we evolved, we took different paths to get there. Some primates adapted internal organs so that they could digest cellulose and extract protein and other nutrients from leaves like herbivores. Some grew long tails and relocated to the treetops, where the good fruit was, and lived off that. Meanwhile, others, the ones who eventually became humanity, moved to the savanna, where they could see both prey and predators coming, and still find enough vegetable matter to supplement their diets. But the one thing that none of these versions of ourselves ever stopped eating, at least when they had the chance, was insects. From lemurs and other New World apes, up through Old World apes like chimpanzees and gorillas, up through prehominids, hominids, Neanderthals, and finally humans, one thing that unites primatehood through the ages is an enduring appetite for bugs. The main reason for this is that insects are a much higher quality food compared to things like leaves, fruits, flowers, and even nuts. Just like other animals, insects are a trophic level 2 food source. They themselves have eaten, and thereby concentrated in their own tissues, the nutrients found in plant sources, providing the sorts of things that primates thrive on: protein, iron, calcium, and best of all, healthy, unsaturated, long-chain, essential fatty acids. Sure, these nutrients can be found in plant sources too, but you have to eat a lot more of them. Insects are these scrumptious little compact packages of food that make surviving and thriving so much easier for a foraging primate. Nutrition is sort of like money. If leaves represent dollar bills, fruits are fives, nuts are tens, and insects and other forms of animal flesh are crisp $50 bills. The nutrients in them are just more concentrated and often more bioavailable, which means the body has to do less work to utilize them. When you think of the hallmarks of evolution, what image pops up? For many, it's the picture of a chimp with a stick, moistened to catch termites. But like a dog that stares at the pointing finger instead of the ball, we've been focusing entirely on the tool and ignoring its ultimate purpose: to capture and consume insects more efficiently. Scientists in the Congo River Basin have observed chimps utilizing a collection of implements, a toolkit, if you will, in order to better harvest termites. One short stick to puncture the above-ground mound, and then a longer, slenderer fishing probe to pull the termites out. This fishing probe was often further modified to increase its effectiveness. The chimps used their teeth to fray the end like a paintbrush, the better to collect the insects with. Infant chimps watch carefully as their mothers collect and customize stick tools, find and puncture termite mounds, and deftly extract the crawling black morsels. It is this process of watching, learning, and assimilating through social interaction and observed behavior that many scientists believe to be the roots of civilization. In fact, as it turns out, the skill of collecting termites is easier observed than done. When the scientists themselves tried to extract termites from the mounds using the same tools and methods the chimps did, they found it quite difficult. We were less successful than most of the chimp youngsters. This is a complex skill that is developed with years of practice, said the appropriately named co-authoring anthropologist Cricket Sons. Humanity's great technological and cultural achievements likely began in much the same way. The earliest bone tools found by archaeologists are thought to have been used specifically for insect gathering. A 2001 study on bone tools left behind by Australopithecus robustus, a million-year-plus-old distant relative to modern humans, theorized that they were used to scrape away at termite mounds in order to harvest the inhabitants. This was the first evidence that our early human ancestors were methodical insectivores. And it's no wonder, according to paleontologist Lucinda Backwell, who co-authored the study, since termites have a higher nutritional content than rump steak. Termites are a valuable source of protein, fat, and essential amino acids in the diets of both primates and modern humans, wrote Blackwell. While rump steak yields 322 calories per 100 grams and codfish 74, termites provide 560 calories per 100 grams. Let's imagine you are an evolving proto-human, and you have this excellent source of protein, fat, and other nutrients, and it doesn't require you to run, throw a spear, or hold your breath. Insect eating during the right seasons is like the drive-through window at McDonald's, a big caloric payoff for comparatively low energetic output. Cordain and other paleo diet advocates and researchers paint a picture of early man as an aggressive and skillful hunter, bringing home piles of meat to his hungry family. But reality was likely quite different. And here is the bug in the system, or rather, the glaring lack thereof. As the author of the blog Paleo Veganology quips, it's as though someone took a big can of Raid to the author's paleo imaginations. So steeped are they in their Western food bias and paleo fantasies that the possibility of Paleolithic man fulfilling his nutrient requirements with a diet of creepy crawlies never occurred to them. Hunting, especially in the Neolithic age, was quite a risky activity, from both a safety and an energy investment standpoint. Twisting an ankle in the bush or being injured by a charging animal without any medical care could mean death. It was also a very hit-or-miss sort of activity. Early hunters experienced about 20% success rate. That means 2 to 3 out of every 10 times they ventured out, they might return with a big dead animal. Granted, some of those kills would feed the tribe for several days or even weeks. But at those rates, they would have starved if not for the steady stream of calories brought in by gathered and foraged food, such as tubers, greens, and small animals that included, to a large extent, insects and other invertebrates. On a day-to-day basis, things like insects would have been a regular fare, the kind of things that kept early people going between big kills. In order to do this type of gathering, though, an animal had to be able to hold things in its hands and still travel. It had to be able to walk upright. You try walking on all fours while holding something in your hands. It's even been suggested that the gathering of things like insects would have influenced our shift to bipedalism. Yes, you could, if you wanted to, even partially credit bugs with your ability to walk. Since it was usually the men doing the hunting, this is the case even in chimpanzee communities, the women would have been the ones gathering, and it's something that can be done with a baby on your back. While the men went out and often came back empty-handed, the women came home every day with at least something to feed the tribe, their mates, and most important, their children. The majority of the day-to-day protein was actually provided by women and, potentially, largely through insects. A 4-year study on savanna chimpanzees conducted by anthropologist Jill Pruitts and Paco Bertolani yielded the observation that it is the female chimps, by and large, who use tools to hunt, not the males. They concluded that this discovery supports a theory that females played a significant role in the evolution of tool technology among the earliest humans. Oh, how times have changed. When an early female hominid saw a bug and shrieked, it was an excitement because, hey, lunch. This article is excerpted with permission of Amazon Publishing, New Harvest. Copyright 2014 by Daniela Martin. Back on the Health and Science page, a breakthrough in nuclear fusion. Scientists have recreated, for a brief instant, the nuclear fusion reaction that powers the sun, taking a major step toward the holy grail of developing fusion as a viable energy resource on Earth. We're closer than anyone's gotten before, physicist Omar Hurricane tells USA Today. He and his colleagues at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory shot 192 lasers with a peak power of 500 trillion watts, roughly 1,000 times the power of output of the entire U.S. grid, at a dime-sized gold cylinder. Inside the cylinder was a pea-sized capsule containing a fuel of two hydrogen isotopes. The laser created enough pressure to crush the fuel capsule to 1/35th of its original size, the equivalent of compressing a basketball to the size of a pea. Under compression, the nucleus of atoms in the fuel fused, generating a temperature higher than that than at the sun's center, and triggering additional nuclear reactions. For the first time anywhere, we've gotten more energy out of the fuel than was put into the fuel, Hurricane says. The challenge ahead is to maintain the high temperatures and pressures required for what's known as ignition, generating a self-sustaining chain reaction. If nuclear fusion can be mastered and controlled, scientists say, it could generate almost limitless amounts of energy from seawater without generating radioactive wastes. The secret to recalling dreams. Why do some people remember their dreams while others almost never do? The answer may depend on both how soundly you sleep and on differences in brain function. French researchers at the Lyon Neuroscience Research Center previously found that so-called high dream recallers experience twice as much wakefulness during sleep as low dream recallers. Their brains also react more to sounds both when sleeping and awake. In a new study, the team wanted to understand how the brains of each type of dreamer differed. Using a specialized imaging technique, researchers measured the spontaneous brain activity of 41 volunteers during wakefulness and in sleep. 21 were high recallers, who remembered their dreams an average of 5.2 mornings per week. The rest were low recallers, who reported 2 dreams per month on average. Whether awake or asleep, the high recallers showed stronger activity in the temporoparietal junction, an area of the brain involved in directing attention toward external stimuli. The researchers concluded that this increased activity likely leads to more frequent awakenings, creating more opportunities to encode dreams in memory. The sleeping brain is not capable of memorizing new information, lead researcher Perrin Ruby tells ScienceDaily.com. It needs to awaken to be able to do that. On the Talking Points page, e-cigarettes, the coming crackdown. The nanny state wants to stub out your electronic cigarette, said Alec Torres in NationalReview.com. From Los Angeles to New York City, Utah to New Jersey, local and state lawmakers are rushing through legislation banning these battery-powered devices, which heat a nicotine solution into a water vapor that users suck in and exhale like smoke, from restaurants, offices, and other public spaces. Politicians argue that they are protecting the public from secondhand vapor. What they're actually doing is squashing the most successful smoking reduction product of the last 15 years. E-cigarettes don't burn tobacco or contain the carcinogenic tar and soot that make traditional cigarettes so dangerous, said Gilbert Ross in DailyCaller.com. Studies show the vapor they emit is harmless, and millions of Americans are now switching from deadly cigarettes to low-risk e-cigs, greatly reducing their risk of developing lung cancer and other smoking-related diseases. Actually, the jury's still out on whether e-cigarettes are safe, said Consumer Reports in an editorial. Even without the smoke, nicotine is a powerful, addictive drug that narrows blood vessels and drives up blood pressure. And because e-cigs are unregulated, you don't necessarily know what's in them. In 2009, the Food and Drug Administration found a toxic chemical used in antifreeze in some e-cigarette samples, and carcinogens in others. Worryingly, a growing number of kids are experimenting with these devices, said Janie Heath in HuffingtonPost.com. In 2012, 10% of high schoolers said they'd puffed on e-cigs, double the number in 2011, which come in an assortment of fruit flavors and brightly colored packages designed to appeal to teens. These products are like training wheels for nicotine addiction, doled out with carelessness and impunity. Not for much longer, said Megan McArdle in Bloomberg Businessweek. The FDA is drafting new rules that will ban e-cigarettes from being sold or marketed to minors and regulate what chemicals are in the vapor. At that point, anti-smoking campaigners will have to make a decision. If they think they can drive smoking rates to zero, they'll use regulations, taxes, and warnings to aggressively discourage e-cig use too. But if they accept that 10 to 20% of Americans will keep smoking for the foreseeable future, meaning tobacco deaths will remain in the hundreds of thousands annually, they will let e-cigs challenge Marlboros, Camels, and Newports for market share. Choose your poison. Social Security, taking reform off the table. Say farewell to the dream of entitlement reform, said Jonathan Tait in NYMag.com. The White House announced last week that President Obama's 2015 budget will not include a plan that Republicans support to reduce Social Security costs. That plan is a new way of calculating cost of living increases in monthly Social Security checks, known as chained CPI, and would save $162.5 billion over the next decade, according to the Congressional Budget Office. In previous grand bargain negotiations with congressional Republicans, Obama had offered to adopt chain CPI in return for Republican support for closing tax loopholes that benefit only the rich, thereby spreading the pain of deficit reduction. Republicans said no because of their fanatical hatred of both Obama and tax increases of any kind. Since it's now clear that Republicans will never, ever, ever strike a fiscal deal with him, Obama is pulling changes to Social Security off the table, as liberals exult and conservatives erupt in hypocritical, anguished wails. Politics aside, the president's abandonment of chain CPIs is a huge disappointment, said the Washington Post in an editorial. The proposal would be a major step toward budgetary sanity and imposes only modest sacrifice on the vast majority of Americans. Obama is being both cynical and irresponsible, said Kevin D. Williamson in NationalReview.com. Just consider how relatively painless this reform would be. For every $1,000 in benefits, Social Security recipients would get $3 less in future increases under chained CPI. That's a trivial amount of money for the individual, but collectively it would produce a major reduction in our deficit spending. Who says it's trivial, said Terry O'Neill in HuffingtonPost.com. When compounded year after year, chain CPI would make a big dent in cost of living increases. Women who spend much of their working years at home caring for children would be particularly hard hit, since they often reach retirement years with smaller savings and no pensions. In effect, this reform could mean that a future 80-year-old retiree would lose roughly a week's groceries every month. To head off unsustainable deficits in the future, though, everyone must make sacrifices, said John Healy in the Los Angeles Times. Sadly, Washington simply isn't capable of making the sort of compromises necessary. Dreams of a grand bargain are dead, at least for this presidency. And a couple of notes. An estimated 80,000 U.S. prisoners are held in solitary confinement, with each one costing taxpayers an average of $60,000 a year. Many of these prisoners descend into severe mental illness and/or suicidal despair, and most are later released back into society. A record number of American babies are being named after guns. In 2012, 955 babies were named Colt, 666 were called Remington, and 118 were named Ruger, after the gun maker Sturm, Ruger and Company. And we'll finish up today with a quote. Beauty, to me, is about being comfortable in your own skin. That or a kick-ass red lipstick. That's from Gwyneth Paltrow, quoted in InStyle.com. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. ¶¶